Excuse me, I'd like to inform parties today's conference is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If anyone needs any further assistance, please press star zero. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sean Brooks. I'm the moderator for CHARM, and I would like to welcome everyone to the April 2013 edition of the CHARM telecom / seminar. Today, I am pleased to bring you Dr. Alex Hayes, who is an associate professor at Cornell at their astronomy department, where he's been since January of this year. He analyzes spacecraft remote sensing data, Titan and Mars, and studies surface processes on those bodies. And I believe it's not just Titan and Mars, but those are the principal objects of his study. And he's currently funded to analyze Titan radar data, that is Titan radar data taken by the radar instrument on the Cassini orbiter that is currently orbiting Saturn. Alex was initially inspired to study planetary science by Steve Squires and Jim Bell, who are working on the Spirit, what would become the Spirit and Opportunity rovers that are currently, well, at least Opportunity is currently operating on Mars. And it was through his interaction with Steve Squires that he was inspired to pursue his Bachelor of Arts in Astronomy at Cornell. He subsequently received a Master of Engineering from Cornell and a Master of Science and his PhD in Planetary Science from Caltech. He followed that up by going to Cal Berkeley for about a year, I think, where he was a Miller Research Professor, Miller Research Fellow, excuse me. And he's also the first recipient of the American Geophysical Union's Ron Greeley Early Career Award in Planetary Science. He's here today to talk to us and tell us about lakefront vacationing on Titan. His talk is titled A Guide to Lakefront Vacationing on Titan, Where to Go and When to Visit. So with no further ado, I bring you Dr. Alex Hayes. Alex, please go ahead.
Sean, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. So I am a fan of having questions asked during the talk, so as long as it continues to work, please just pester me with anything you find interesting as we go along. I split this talk into primarily three sections. The first section just talking about the history of exploration on Titan and broad brush of what we found, and at least why I find it so interesting and exciting a place to study, followed by section two will be a quick review of some of the most recent observations and analysis that a group of us have been doing in the North Polar region of Titan that's been bearing some really interesting implications for the way that landscape was developed and telling us something about the hydrologic system and how the lakes interact with the other landforms on Titan. And then the third section of the talk will actually be why I was invited to give this lecture, which will talk about a recent paper that we put out on explaining how you would generate waves in a Titan hydrocarbon lake or sea, and possibly explaining why we haven't seen waves on the lakes that we've observed yet, and predicting perhaps when we might in the future. And before I move on, if you look at my title slide, as I give my talk, by the way, I'll try to yell out the page numbers, but if anyone gets lost along the way, just shout out and interrupt me, and we'll get you back on track. There's a wide list of collaborators and co-authors on that list, on that title page, and they deserve a significant amount of credit for what you're going to see, and there's a lot of people who, unfortunately, I didn't have room to put on the slide, but I definitely want to acknowledge their contributions. And if we move on to slide two, if I'm going to be your tour guide for lakefront vacationing on Titan, and I should also point out that depending how long it takes us to get through the core slides, there's a possible bonus of desert front vacationing on Titan at the end, doing some of the research we've been performing for the dunes. But I just felt if I'm going to be a tour guide, I have to have a cheesy travel brochure, and so you can just see that on slide two and take it for what it is. Moving on to slide three, we should see a picture of Titan as well as a plate from a paper by Gerard Kuiper in 1944. And Titan is the largest moon of Saturn, was initially discovered by Christopher Huygens in the late 17th century, and then the next large event in Titan exploration came from a Spanish astronomer named Joseph Camarasola, who said that he believed he observed limb darkening on Titan in a paper he published in 1907, which would suggest it has a substantial atmosphere. As we know today, Titan does. In fact, it's the only moon in the solar system with a substantial atmosphere, and The first images of Titan came from the Pioneer 11 spacecraft, which showed a hazy orange ball, not unlike the photo that you're seeing on the slide, which is actually from Voyager 1. And as many of you on the telecon already know, this interesting observation of verifying that we had a large atmosphere, which was, by the way, also suggested by the paper by Kuiper I'll mention in a second, was actually led to the diversion of the Voyager 1 spacecraft out of the solar system's ecliptic so that it could encounter Titan and perform the science that led the groundwork for what will later be the Cassini mission, which is currently orbiting Saturn and where most of the data that we'll talk about in the rest of the presentation come from. What Gerard Kuiper did was look at the spectrum of Titan's atmosphere and saw methane absorption lines, which suggested that there was at least a significant fraction of methane in its atmosphere, which now we have a body that has a substantial atmosphere, which is interesting, and not only that, it has methane in its atmosphere, which was known to be an ephemeral species since it can be broken apart by photodissociation in the upper atmosphere from high-energy particles from either the Sun or Saturn's magnetosphere. When Voyager later encountered Titan, through radio occultation experiments, and this is amazing, they were able to get these results, in my opinion, they said that the atmosphere itself was most consistent with having a surface pressure of 1.5 bars. Titan had a radius of 2,575 kilometers, and that the methane content in the atmosphere could be at the surface something like 5%, and that the surface temperature was likely around 95 Kelvin. And if we combine all that information together, that gives Titan a very interesting scenario where, as I'm hinting to in the lower left-hand portion of this plot, if we just looked at a phase diagram of methane and put the partial pressure and temperature of Titan's methane contribution on that plot, we see it's near the triple point so that solid, liquid, and gaseous phases can coexist. And that's similar to our situation of water here on Earth, which led some people to think that we could have an entire hydrologic system operating on Titan. And in fact, one of the early papers on Titan by Jonathan Lunin suggested that the primary photolysis product of methane, ethane, would also be a liquid at Titan conditions. And in a landmark paper in 1983, he suggested that you might actually find a global ocean of liquid on Titan that's the product of methane photolysis over geologic time. And so when the Cassini mission, which is NASA's current flagship mission that this telecon is based on, was launched, it included a contribution from ESA, as we all know, known as the Huygens probe, which was designed to either land in liquid, if there was a global liquid ethane ocean, or liquid methane ethane ocean, or solid land. And that led to a very, very interesting and exciting condition just about the time that I was starting to get involved in outer planet science. And if we move to slide 4, this just shows the excitement at least at the California Institute of Technology during that time, where this is just an image taken by Mike Brown on his digital camera in the fall of 2004 for the betting pool that was in the Caltech brunch break room about what Huygens would actually land in, whether it be ice, tar, liquid, undeterminable, dead on arrival, or Dave Stevenson actually suggested it'd be eaten by a monster. But it just showed this was so exciting because we had no idea what the Huygens probe was going to see, what it was going to land in. And then if we move on to slide 5, we actually see the images from the Huygens probe showing that when it landed at the equatorial region of Titan, it landed not on a liquid ocean, as we knew beforehand, in fact, that there likely was not a liquid ocean based on some HST imaging. But instead, Luce landed in an area that was very similar to what we would call an alluvial plain on Earth. The image in the upper right of slide 5 shows one of the images, or three images, mosaics from the defense camera of the Huygens probe, showing some nice channel networks coming off of some dendritic channel networks coming off of a hillside, emptying into what looks like an alluvial plain where the actual probe landed that was scattered with decimeter scale cobbles, presumably made of water ice, that looked like they had been rounded during fluvial transport. There was no liquid observed by the Huygens probe, although it did find liquid contained in pore space just underneath in the regolith just below the Huygens probe itself. And the image in the lower right is a graphic artist's representation of the Huygens probe, not an actual image from some camera that was launched from the probe itself, which is a question I get in lectures quite a bit, so I'll just make that clear. But the liquid was not found. And before we move on to the next slide, I just thought to give you a sense of Titan's atmosphere, I like to think about it as compared to Earth's atmosphere in the equivalent liquid depth. So on Earth, if we took the entire atmosphere, all the nitrogen in our atmosphere, and we condensed it to a global ocean, we'd get something on the order of 10 to 13 meters thick. So the atmosphere of Earth is equivalent to a 10 to 13 meter thick layer of global nitrogen ocean. If you did the same thing on Titan, which is a pressure of 1.5 bars, but has 1/7 of gravity, you'd end up with 140 meter global ocean. So in terms of liquid ocean equivalent depth, Titan has 10 times more depth associated with this atmosphere than Earth does. And then the volatile in Earth's atmosphere, water, if we took all the water out of our atmosphere and condensed it down to a global layer, it would be about a centimeter thick, about 1 inch thick. If you did the same thing for liquid methane on Titan, you get something like 7 to 8 meters thick. So we're talking a factor of about 100, or a couple of hundred or so, in terms of increased size of a global liquid equivalent disk. So Titan is literally awash in its volatile methane. But as we saw from the Huygens image, we haven't found any of those large-scale liquid deposits that we'd expect to have balanced the loss of methane from photolysis over geologic time. And the early estimates for how long it would take to destroy all the methane in Titan's atmosphere is about 10 to the 7 years. But the liquids were discovered in the polar regions. The first paper that is attributed with the discoveries by Ellen Stofan in 2007 from radar data, but perhaps one of the more iconic photos taken, at least in my opinion, by the Cassini spacecraft was taken by the Visual Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, VIMS, that I show on slide 6 from a paper by Stefan in GRL in 2010, which was just a chance observation that showed a surface glint off of a northern lake that has later been named Jingpo Lakis, which means mirror lake in Mandarin. It's a lake in Japan, I believe. And the Titan just happened to be at the correct geometry such that sunlight was able to specularly reflect off of that lake surface and then come towards the VIMS spacecraft, creating a beautiful glint that we see in slide 6. And we'll talk about the liquid on Titan in both the latter sections of this talk, but coming off of it for now, in slide 7, I just am giving a quick overview of the Cassini spacecraft shown on the left side, with the Huygens probe just outside the field of view rotated in the back of the room there, showing a little CAD drawing of it in the central part of the frame. And we're imaging Titan's hazy atmosphere. The haze primarily being caused by a layer of photolysis products in the upper atmosphere with the Cassini radar, which is a 2.16 centimeter synthetic aperture radar, which gives us microwave band images of the surface, as well as fuzzy, highly scattered images from the ISS, the Imaging Science Subsystem, which is a near-infrared telescope, and then the hyperspectral VIMS instruments, the Visual Infrared Mapping Spectrometer. One thing to keep in mind when we're looking at images that come from the radar, which gives us the best resolution of the surface at about 300 meters, sometimes as low as 250 meters or 220 near closest approach, we're looking at an image generated from a wavelength of about 2 centimeters, so we're primarily interacting with the surface on length scales of 2 centimeters, and interacting with how reflective and transmissive material is at 2 centimeters. And just to give you a rule of thumb, the one-way absorption length for water on Earth is less than a millimeter. So the amount of length you have to penetrate through water to make it opaque to radar, for it to be black, is 1 millimeter, whereas methane's one-way absorption, if it's pure, is something on the order of 2 meters or greater. So you can see through the liquid content perhaps significantly more than radar would see through water's liquid content, unless we have polar contributions or other more complex hydrocarbons mixed in with the liquids, which could very well be possible. But also the surface itself. When you look at a radar image of Earth and you're looking at the salts, you're mainly looking at surface reflections and that you're not going to penetrate down much more than a few centimeters. Whereas with a broken up water ice crust, which is the primary constituent of Titan's surface, is thought to be broken up water ice with a veneer of hydrocarbon that's been generated through photolysis over geologic time, you could potentially see through meters of that material. So when you look at the surface, you may not only be seeing the surface, you may be seeing some reflections from the subsurface as well. So you just have to keep that in mind when you look at these images and realize that the materials we're looking at are very different than materials we look at here on Earth. But nevertheless, on slide 8, I'm showing again Titan as seen by the Voyager spacecraft, where its video-con cameras could not penetrate through that thick and hazy atmosphere, to what we see today, which is slide 9, showing a false color image of radar swaths projected in an orthographic projection on Titan's globe, overlaid on top of a lower resolution but global in extent 5-micron map from VIMS. Actually, it's a false color image of 5 microns and 2 2-micron bands. And the reason, obviously, that we see these radar swaths as oblique strips across the surface is because Cassini is in orbit around Saturn, not Earth. And when you look at the details of these images, you find an amazingly diverse world with geologic structures that have very great similarity to structures that we see here on Earth and also observed on Mars and Venus. And if you move to slide 10, I just want to take you through a quick tour of the type of surface morphologies that dominate Titan that we have seen. And if you're in the equatorial regions, you find these beautiful images of longitudinal dunes that are similar in size to the largest linear dunes that we see in the Earth in the Namib Sand Sea. And they're dark to radar and thought to be made up of 100-meter high, 300-meter wide piles of plastic, which is just something I always have to think again to get my head wrapped around it. These are piles of sand, dune material made of hydrocarbon solids, or at least we think that they're made of hydrocarbon solids, yet they still form and generate patterns that look extremely similar to large-scale dunes that we see here on Earth, and even interact with topographic obstacles in the dune fields. These bright features that you're seeing here are called inselbergs, and they're about a couple hundred meters, a kilometer max, high topographic obstacles sitting in the dune field, and the dunes flow around them like water does rocks in a stream. And they've been used to try and infer the flow direction of the dunes, the wind directions on Titan, and you find these features pervasively within 30 degrees of Titan's equator. Moving on to slide 11, we also see fluvial processes associated with flowing liquid in the surface and subsurface that generate channels, presumably channels of liquid hydrocarbon that have been carved into some mixture of organic and or water ice bedrock. And not only do we see channels, but we see different channel morphologies. We see dendritic networks with acute branching angles that are consistent with surficial flow. We see in the middle part of the slide there, you're seeing things that look like terrestrial embayments in wetlands. We see large sinuous channels that suggest very shallow gradients that they're flowing along down in the south. And in the lower left of this plot, there's radar bright braided channels that are flowing into this large bright deposit near the crater Minerva. And this area has been interpreted as a large-scale alluvial fan on Titan. So not only do we see channels, but we see dark channels near the poles that are presumably partially filled with liquid or at least sediment today. We see bright channels near the equator that have been interpreted as having dry beds or very shallow beds that are filled with these decimeter-scale water ice cobbles we saw at the Huygens landing site. And those decimeter-scale water ice cobbles would be very bright to radar, making these channels bright. And then we also see channels that seem to flow into alluvial fans. We find channels that flow into lakes. Just a wide variety of morphologies associated with fluvial processes, just like we see here on Earth. And then, of course, what we'll be discussing a good portion of this talk on slide 12, we see lacustrine processes. And this is an image of La Giammare, one of the larger seas in Titan's north polar region, similar in size to Earth's Great Lakes. I won't talk much about it now because we're going to focus on this lake again in about 10 minutes or so. But beautiful lacustrine processes that look like there are standing bodies of liquid stable on Titan's surface, making it the only other place that we know of currently to support standing bodies of liquid and have an active hydrologic system in addition to Earth. Now, moving on to slide 13, I'm showing some panels from a paper by Zibi Turtle that came out in Science about a year and a half ago now that show pluvial processes in Titan, and pluvial processes are processes associated with rainfall, and the panels A through H show the progression of 4 years of an equatorial area of Titan where there was a large-scale cloud system that came through, and following that cloud system, about a 500,000 square kilometer area was darkened, presumably by a large-scale rain event. And then later on, as time progressed, that dark parts of that dark area have returned to their original brightness, suggesting that we wetted the surface with some kind of large-scale rain event, and that liquid then either evaporated back into the atmosphere or penetrated into the ground to move the surface back to its original brightness, but showing that we have large-scale equatorial storms on Titan. We've also seen darkening events following clouds and presumably rainstorms in the South Polar region as well that Zibi has written about in the past in a 2009 paper in GRL, showing a collection of dark features, presumably liquid deposits or lakes on the surface that appeared following a large-scale storm system in the 2005 timeframe. On slide 14, we also see impact. We can show two examples of Titan's impact craters, showing that impact processes are also possible. Do I hear a question? Okay, no. I'll just keep going then. And we see impact structures on Titan. The two that I'm showing here on the left is Minerva, which is named after the Etruscan goddess of war. You can see the alluvial fan, which is right next to Alviger Flumina channel system that we mentioned earlier, just next to it. And then to the right is Sinlap crater, which is named after I believe it's a Jingpo spirit, which is interesting because Jingpo is also the name for the mirror lake that we talked about earlier. But one thing that's interesting about craters on Titan is there are only a dozen or so craters that we actually are sure are craters, and then a lot of features that may be highly degraded previous craters. But the point is there are very few craters on Titan's surface, speaking to a fairly young surface age. I think the oldest estimates I've heard are about a billion years. And it's also latitudinally asymmetric in the sense that the near equator, you don't see any channel, you don't see any craters above about 50 or so degrees from the equator. 50 north to the North Pole, 50 south to the South Pole, there really are no craters, which some authors have attributed potentially to the polar regions being younger, the surface age of the polar regions being younger than the equator, and we'll get to why that's important a little bit later as well. And then I'll just finish up our quick tour of the varied geomorphologies observed on Titan's surface on slide 15 with an image, bless you, with an image of Doom Mons, and Sotra Petrera. Doom Mons is named after Mount Doom from the H.R. Tolkien books, J.R. Tolkien, sorry, and Doom Mons is a 2-kilometer-high mountain that you see to the right side of this plot. This is a three-dimensional view of the area produced by Randy Kirk in an LPSA abstract in 2011, and Doom's Mon, a 2-kilometer mountain, sits right next to Sotra Petrera, which is a 2-kilometer hole in the ground, just next to it. And this region is currently the leading candidate for potential endogenic processes, which have yet to be proven to exist on Titan, but are actually suggested by this observation, and that this might be some kind of cryovolcanic event to generate this hole in mountain. So moving on to slide 16, just to make my point abundantly clear, I'm saying Titan really is a new world for study that has very similar surface morphologies that we find on Earth, Mars, and Venus. So despite vastly different environmental conditions and atmospheric conditions on these bodies, we find the same processes shaping their surface, which as a quantitative geomorphologist, which is how I classify a mass majority of my research, makes Titan a natural laboratory for studying these processes and makes it exciting to actually see how the physics would work under completely different conditions with completely different materials. And then moving on to slide 17 is a little box diagram that shows us Titan's methane cycle and how it really drives surface evolution, showing many of the inputs and outputs that we mentioned on the previous slide. Near the top, we have destruction of methane from Titan's atmosphere on timescales of 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 years, generating higher-order hydrocarbons in an organic chemical engine in the upper atmosphere, the primary product of which is ethane, which will go to fill your polar lakes and seas, and then more solid products like acetylene, benzene-type products will possibly rain out of the surface, create a surface veneer that's then processed into your equatorial dunes, and that you have your lakes are mainly stable by the poles. There's interaction between the poles, transport of material, and that your equatorial region is generally arid with rewetting occurring with large-scale rainouts on timescales of 10 to 1,000 years, And some of the primary questions that we have yet to ask is, how interconnected are these landforms through any kind of subsurface alcanifer or subsurface equivalent of a water table? Do they even exist regionally in the polar regions? Is there subsurface communication in the trough? Where is the source for the ethane that, for the methane that resupplies the atmosphere? Where's the source for the sink of ethane? Those are still fundamental questions with many theories as to where the sources and sinks of that material could be, and it may actually take another spacecraft to answer them, which means we should go back to Titan, which I'm always going to advocate for. Moving on to talking about the lakes in slide 18, I'm showing the most up-to-date distribution of Titan's hydrologic features. And when you look at this map, the colors correspond to the incidence angle of the radar swaths, and the polygons, blue polygons, are features that we have interpreted as liquid-filled lakes. They're dark features that have borders that look like that look similar to lakes and are completely black to the radar. They're at the radar's noise floor, suggesting that you had a very smooth surface that was completely absorbing and reflecting energy away from the radar. And then there are the cyan polygons represent places where things are not quite dark enough to call it a lake. They may involve liquids, so it's either moist mudflats, like we think the large-scale areas potentially in the South Polar region are, all the way up to shallow bodies of liquid that could exist in the North Polar region that are shallow enough that the radar actually can penetrate through and interact with the lake bed. And then the final type of feature that we've seen is represented by the red polygons, and we'll talk more about this particular feature in a little bit, that have been called bright lakes, which are really empty paleolake basins that range in depth from 200 to 800 meters deep and have bright floored deposits, as I'll show a little bit later, that have been interpreted as evaporitic deposits left over from evaporating previous liquid methane, methane-ethane hydrocarbons that existed in the holes. You can see the largest lakes on Titan are similar in size to Earth's Great Lakes, which I show for scale in the middle bottom of the plot, and that they take up about 1% by area of the entire globe that we've observed, but they're heavily concentrated, as you can see from the figure, in the north, taking up about 11% or so of the observed area north of 60 degrees, but only 0.7% of the area in the south. In fact, there's only one really large body that we think currently has at least partial liquid in it, called Ontario Lacus on the South Pole. And so the aerial coverage of potentially liquid-filled bodies is 26 times greater in the north than in the south, which is our first large-scale question of how could that be, how do we potentially answer that question. In general, this slide's a little bit old. I forgot to update it. The swath coverage on Titan globally is up to about 50%. We've seen about half of the surface. And in each, the north and the south were a little over 60% today of observed coverage. And now if we move to slide 19, and for those of you that have downloaded the movie, you can get it ready, but don't turn it on just yet. I'm going to propose a potential explanation for why we saw that liquid in the north as opposed to the south. And we published this idea in a paper that was led by Zeta Harrison in Nature Geosciences in December of 2009. And what it comes down to really is that just by chance, when it's summer in Titan's south polar region, you're 9 AU away from the sun. But when it's summer in Titan's north polar region, summer solstice, you're 10 AU from the sun. You're at aphelion, or the furthest distance from the sun, as opposed to perihelion, or the closest distance from the sun when you're at southern summer. And in this figure, or the slide, and the movie, what you're seeing is Titan, which orbits around the sun along Saturn's eccentric orbit. Titan is tidally locked to Saturn with a rotation period of 16 days, but its seasons are governed by Saturn's seasons. And that currently, when you're in summer in the south, you're 1 AU closer, so you have 25% higher peak flux shining down on you. So southern summers are hotter. And if we remember Kepler's third law, when you're closer, you're also moving faster. So the total integrated amount of energy that you receive during any season is still going to be the same, versus northern versus southern summer, but it's going to be hotter. Summers are hotter and faster in the south and cooler and longer in duration in the north. So any nonlinear mechanisms that do not depend linearly on received flux can potentially transport more material or evaporate or move volatiles more readily from the south to the north. And if you do this over many seasonal cycles, you end up with a situation where you can envision moving large amounts of volatile, such as ethane, which may not be movable over seasonal timescales, but is certainly movable over tens of thousands of years, to the north and build up all the lakes and seas of the north at the expense of the liquid reservoirs in the south. The reason this is a movie is because if we believe that this is the explanation for why we see all the lakes in the north versus the south, we have to also understand that these orbital parameters change, and if you use Newton's equations to integrate back the orbital parameters of Saturn over the past 50,000 years on this plot, and you just hit play in the movie, what the movie is showing you is how Titan seasons vary in position on Saturn's eccentric orbit. And the plot on the bottom shows the solar, the peak solar insolation in the peak sunlight in the north and the south over time. And what you see is that 35,000 years ago, you're in the exact opposite situation to today, where southern summer is now hotter, is now colder and slower than northern summer. And that when you go back to About 35,000 years ago, you're in the exact same situation, and you've gone through it. Oh, sorry. Reflect. I was correct. 35,000 years ago, you're in the exact opposite situation. 50,000 years ago, you're back to you are today. So you basically have to move that liquid from the north to the south on 50,000-year cycles that are associated with the changing orbital parameters of Saturn's eccentric orbit around the sun and Titan, the position of Titan seasons in those. And there's an analogy to this process on Earth. On slide 20, I allude to it. Kroll-Milankovitch cycles are thought to be a primary cause of glacial cycles, glaciation on Earth. And this orbital variations that may be associated with where we see the liquid and whether it be the north or the south pole on Titan is the analog of Titan's Milankovitch periods. And we also believe Mars also has significant Milankovitch-Dale periods that change its obliquity radically. On Titan, it's not the obliquity that's changing, it's the position of the seasons on the eccentric orbit, but the concept is the same, and that 50,000-year cycles is a fairly short time geologically to move that much material back and forth, and has interesting implications for how you modify and change the polar regions, and may link back to why we don't see many craters in the poles, since you're potentially moving this material back and forth and modifying the polar landscapes on timescales much faster than you're modifying geologically, at least the equatorial regions. Did I hear a question? No. So if we move to slide 21, this shows an example of the different kinds of lakes that we see on Titan. Not only do we see lakes, but we see radiometrically what we would call bright lakes, which are the small features that 10 kilometers or so average log normal distribution, in addition to the large-scale hundreds of kilometers seas, or mare, that we think are liquid-filled depressions. And then you also see a feature we initially call bright lakes, because they look like lakes and they're bright, that turned out to be, through altimetry measurements and stereo DTMs, 200 to 800 meters deep holes in the ground with really interesting floors. So typically, I mentioned that radar is interacting with the surface at the scale comparable to its wavelength of centimeters. And when you see a bright area of a radar image versus a dark area of a radar image, your first intuition is to say, oh, one's rougher at the scale of centimeters. This is a rougher surface, therefore it's scattering more energy back towards me, so that's why it's brighter in the imaging. One way to test if that's true is when you look straight down at something in an altimetry mode, which the radar can also do on Cassini, instead of looking off to the side and creating images, you can also look straight down to get altimetric distance to the surface and how bright it is when you look straight down at it. And you can imagine that when you look at something that's very rough and you're looking straight down at it, you're scattering the radiation into other angles than the incidence angle, and so it should be dark, as opposed to when you're looking at it from the side, it should be bright. And a smooth surface, equivalently, should reflect all the radiation away from you when you're looking off-axis, right? Just think about shining a laser pointer at a mirror, versus when you look straight down at it. What's really interesting about these bright lakes are that they're brighter than their surroundings at both off-axis and on-axis angles. When you're looking straight down or nadir, it's bright, and when you're looking off, it's bright, which means something else is causing these things to be bright, either because there's a completely different composition of material in the lake bed, or there's some organized structure in the subsurface. Either way, whatever's in the floor of these bright lake deposits is different stuff than the stuff surrounding it, than the terrain that surrounds it. And VIMS has recently shown that it has a compositional difference in the infrared in its infrared band depth at 5 microns, which suggests that we're looking at evaporite deposits of hydrocarbon evaporite on Titan. And we'll get more to these features again in a little bit. There's been a recent discovery on them. And if you move to slide 22, this follows directly from my statement of being able to look at different incidence angles to figure out what the surface is made of. And because now Cassini is in its 8th year of operation, and we're in the second extended mission, what's really exciting is not only are we seeing Titan surface, but we're seeing it multiple times. And in this chart, slide 22, I'm showing you, based on the colors and the plots in the upper part of the graphic, how many times different parts of the polar regions have been observed to date. And you can imagine that this is only going to increase as we move the mission forward, and we have more polar passes. Two of very exciting ones are coming up, in fact, this summer. And having seen a place multiple times allows you to do some analysis that you couldn't do before, and that's been the focus of our research here most recently, is exploiting these areas where we have multiple images to look for temporal evolution. Do we see anything changing? The answer to tell you quickly is that we haven't seen anything changing in the north, but I'll show you that more in a little bit. To then say, okay, if we've seen it at a collection of different observational geometries, incidence angles, what can that tell us about the nature of the surface when you study the backscatter curve? And then third, and perhaps most importantly, by looking at the way that the topography lays over and is projected onto the surface in these images at different incidence angles, you can exploit that to make stereo images the same way that you've seen some of these beautiful stereo models generated from high-rise data on Mars. Randy Kirk and his team and us here at Cornell have been trying to, Randy's been doing this for many years, generate DTMs of Titan's surface from these overlapping observations. One example of which is shown here in slide 22. And for the next 10 slides ago or so, I want to really analyze this DTM and show you how going to the third dimension of knowing what the elevation of the surface is really tells us a lot about the landscape and is opening up completely new doors for Titan research, because now we can talk about the quantitative analysis of morphologic forum. We can see how different morphologies, different lakes relate to each other, put this in time sequence of events, and really interact with the process that's driving their evolution and shape. Moving on to slide 23 is a false color image of Legia Mare, one of the large Mare on Titan, the most well-studied lake, you could arguably say, on the planet. It's the only Mare that we have full coverage of to date. And it shows beautiful examples of different shoreline morphologies that indicate drowned topography. So the shoreline can be broken up into two primarily distinct morphologies associated with drowned topography. You have what you would be described as trunnulated terrain, which is the really rough terrain. An example is the islands. It looks like you're flooding mountainous terrain, not so much mountainous terrain, but at least topographically varying terrain. And then you see other areas of very smooth shorelines that look like you're flooding flat plains. But either way, the morphology of Legia's shoreline is consistent with basically flooding a basin that's made up of much of the same topographic signature as the area surrounding the lake. And it suggests a pre-existing terrain that was both dissected and flat-lying. And if we look in detail at some of the channels that flow into Legia Mare, which essentially flow radially into the lake, except for one shining example that is flowing parallel to the shoreline, on slide 24, I'm showing you one of these channel systems that flow into the lake that end in drowned river valleys, or what they're called. The top part of the slide 24 is Legia Mare, and the bottom part of slide 24 is an image of George's River in Sydney, Australia, taken by the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission. C-band, but this is actually from AirSTAR, not the SRTM. In both examples, you're looking at previously dissected terrain that was once a fluvial drainage system that has had the liquid level rise up, and you're drowning or flooding it. And what this is telling you is that you have drowned valleys, which indicate once well-drained upland landscapes that have now been swamped by rising fluid levels, and the sedimentation or deposition of sediment at the end of the channel system is not keeping pace with the basal rise. So this really tells us the presence of these things, which have been known for a while, but have strong implications to process, tell us two things. One, that you're in a state of liquid level rise in the North Polar region, or at least have been for some period of time, to flood this terrain like this, and that, two, at some point the liquid level was lower, and it stayed lower long enough to dissect the terrain that generated the valley systems that you're now flooding. And if you move into slide 25, I can show an example in the eastern part of Kraken Mare, which is another large Mare on Titan, showing dissection of a different channel system that just is much smaller scale in terms of the individual tributaries, that show that you have dissection at multiple scales as well. Now, I did mention before that most channel systems radially flow into Lygia, and on slide 26 I'm showing one channel system that doesn't. And it's a very interesting channel system that has two large channels that you can see that are flowing parallel to the shoreline of Lygia Mare, and that's an interesting situation because the current topographic slope or downhill direction would be perpendicular to the shoreline of a lake, right? If you want to move downhill, you typically move towards the liquid. It's odd for channels to flow parallel to that direction, and it can be explained by really three different things. Either you have some kind of pre-existing weakness in the terrain that makes your liquid want to flow along that direction like a fault. Alternatively, you could have changed the topography so that there was a pre-existing drainage network, and then something happened to cause the basin formation, which ultimately became the hole that Lygia Mare filled in, and that you've changed the topography. Or third, which is looking more likely based on some detailed analysis of some denoise data that I'll talk about in a second, that there was actually a piece of this channel system that did almost a 90-degree turn there and flew into the lake, but we've completely flooded that area out with the rising fluid levels of the GMRA, so we can't easily see it. The difference between the top and bottom of this slide is that radar is, in general, synthetic aperture radar has a noise source called speckle noise, which is a multiplicative noise source with an exponential distribution that causes the specular granular nature of radar images and is just inherent to the physical process of making them, and you'll see it in every radar image. You can reduce it by either reducing your spatial resolution and averaging pixels together, or alternatively, since we know the physics of what causes this noise source, incoherent and coherent scatter of things on the surface at exactly wavelengths and half wavelengths apart, you can try to remove it using a denoising algorithm with Antoine Lucas developed during his postdoc at Caltech, and the results of that algorithm are shown here on the bottom part of the slide. And what they really show nicely is Lygia Mare encroaching into this channel network and maybe even having some erasure of material, or at least flooding material, and showing us that there could be parts of the channel network that we just aren't seeing anymore. On slide 27, we're really getting to the new results that I was hoping you'd find exciting during this telecon. And the first thing that I wanted to do when I got my hands on the DTM of the North Polar region, the most up-to-date DTM we have so far, is see if I can understand how deep Lygia Mare was. One of the fundamental questions is how deep are these lakes, how deep are these seas? And one way to possibly look at that is morphologically Lygia Mare looks like you're flooding pre-existing terrain that's topographically varying. Well, one of the more common ways to incise terrain like that, and we thought was important on Titan based on the presence of channels, is fluvial incision. And so when you cut a surface up and dissect it by fluvial processes, you leave behind V-shaped valleys that can become U-shaped by deposition of sediment, but you still create these V-shaped, U-shaped valleys. And so if we look at the height of the island over the sea, which is what I'm showing in slide 27, is on the left and right panels, I'm showing a white line across some of the islands of Lygia Mare, and then the DTM of those islands on the right, which shows that they're about 400 meters above the elevation of the liquid surface. And if you connected the lines for those little topographic islands till they connected at a point at the bottom, if you assumed that originally you had a V-shaped valley that's been flooded, the difference between the current liquid level and where your intersection point lies, which is probably about 300 meters if you do it the same way I did, below the current liquid level, you'd say that the liquid was 300 meters deep here, and hey, we've just estimated the depth of this large-scale sea. It's a great idea. The problem is that when you look off, looking at slide 28, off of Lygia Mare, you would expect to see U-shaped or reshaped, V-shaped valleys, and in fact, we do not see that, which is very interesting. One of the fundamental results from these DTMs is showing us that instead of seeing U-shaped or V-shaped valleys, the general terrain in the North Polar region of Titan is closed topographic depressions. The difference between a closed topographic depression and the V-shaped valleys I expect to see from fluvial incision is that there's a way in and out of a valley, right? That's the way the liquid flows. Whereas these closed topographic depressions, if you got inside one of these contour holes, so to explain the DTM for those of you that aren't used to seeing it, color corresponds to height on the right-hand side, and the lines are contour lines of constant elevation. And so when I say closed topographic contours, I mean that if you jump in some of these holes, there's no way to get out without going uphill. That's not how you cannot create a terrain like that through fluvial incision. And I can emphasize that even more in slide 29 by looking at some of the terrain just to the east, southeast of Legia Mare, where you can really see those blue depressions there that are closed topographic depressions. There's no way out of them without going back uphill once you get inside. And you cannot generate this terrain through fluvial incision. What this kind of conically shaped depression suggests is removal of material from below, such as collapse processes or dissolution-based processes that are analogous to, say, karst on Earth, is one way you can do this. But whatever mechanism you want to generate the landscape in Titan's polar regions, you have to take advantage of something that produces closed topographic depressions. What I also noticed when I looked at this DTM is that there are, seems to be levels of constant flat terrain. In the yellow color, for instance, here, there's areas that look like they might involve planation. So immediately when you see this terrain, you think of two processes. Something to generate closed topographic depression, some dissection mechanism to create holes in the ground, and then some planation mechanism to plane it off. And when you look at slide 30, we look at another area just to the south of Legia Mare, and what we see is an area now that looks like it might be filled by plateaus or areas of flat, bordered by steep gradients, reach relatively steep gradients. And in slide 31, what I'm showing is a histogram of this terrain that's got a bimodal nature to it, and that bimodal nature suggests that there are different peaks in this terrain. And one way that, and the end result of the mechanisms that say dissection and planation may result in a plateau topography like what we see here, and so you might just see two stages of evolution. And I know I spent a lot of time explaining this, but it's really important, and it's going to govern how we think Titan's polar regions and hydrologic system works, because water ice is not soluble in liquid methane or ethane. The liquid hydrocarbons we have will not dissolve away water ice, so you have to have some other material that can create these 800-meter holes in the ground through dissolution-based processes or collapse-based processes, and that really means you need a very thick layer of something other than water ice on the surface, and it's a fundamental problem of what that material is and how that might work, and that's a field of ongoing research. One way to think of it is, you know, think of dropping acetylene on a really thick layer of styrofoam, as Mike Malaska, a radar team associate, put it. And so I want to get onto the waves, which is our exciting new paper. So the last two slides I'm going to talk about on this topic are slides 32 and 33. 32 just moves us to the South Polar region and shows one of these equatorial dark regions that are not filled currently with liquid but are very dark to radar in their topographic basins that may represent paleoseas. They would be the place liquid would pool if you moved all the liquid from the north to the south. And in slide 33, I'm just making the point that we see channel systems there as well that suggest a dynamic landscape just like we see in the north. And the bright things that I've marked in red on slide 33 are thought to be incision that's retreating the wall of this depression, and that's incising into a pre-existing landscape that actually dips the other way, as referenced by the yellow channels. And so by digging into the morphology of the channels and the topography we see in the polar regions of Titan, we can really start to tell the story of how the landscape evolved and come up with understanding how Titan works. On slide 34, I don't think I'll spend as much time on this as I was planning to, but I will say that what we're hoping is that by looking at how small lakes evolve with time, we can say how important subsurface communication between those features are, because the smaller a lake is, the larger part of its liquid body is interacting with the subsurface versus the atmosphere. But on slide 35, I'm showing some of the latest results from our recent path last year that says that the North Polar region, which has been in winter, which GCMs predict will be a quiescent time of liquid hydrocarbon activity in terms of evaporation and precipitation, have those lakes have done nothing between the 6 years of September 2006 to May 2012, Yet we're hoping, as we move into northern spring and summer, Cassini solstice mission is so named because it will be at Titan until 2017, which is the solstice, and we'll see variation in these lakes. And if we see lake changes, then we can start talking about the subsurface connectivity of them and how the surface is going to be required to evolve. And then in slide 36, I'm bringing up those empty depressions, which I've already talked about, and slide 36 is just showing one of those holes in the ground. And slide 37 is showing a DTM of those holes in the ground, and that this particular paleo basin, or empty lake, if you want to call it, is about a 300-meter deep hole. And what having a wide DTM allows us to do, instead of looking at one-off holes in the ground like this, we can look at a range of them. And in slide 38, I'm showing a plot that shows 12 different empty lakes that happen to lie in our region of DTM. The bottom part labels them. And then their depths range from 250 meters to 850 meters, ranging by a factor of almost 3 to 4. What's interesting is this is their relative depth. So this is the depth of the bottom of the basin compared to its top, so how deep the hole is. But if we just care about the absolute elevation of the floor of the feature, which is slide 39, they all collapse, minus two of them, to an elevation consistent with the elevation of the shoreline of Lagia Mare. So we're saying that the bottom floor of these empty lakes is at the same topographic elevation relative to Titan's geoid, or center of mass as well, than the shoreline of the lake is. And that's a really important topic that's telling us that somehow the liquid level of the lake, of the large seas, is governing in this region, at least, the absolute elevation of these empty lakes. So whatever those holes are being cut down to a common elevation, which may be associated with a subsurface liquid table. In slide 40 and 41, I'm just showing that the two ones that did not match that interpretation of being consistent with the shoreline of Lagia Mare are, in fact, examples of a lake that we did not get full coverage of, so it could go deeper. And in 42, a feature that turned out to be a misidentification of a bright region within a mountainous terrain, not actually standing in the typical terrain. So this one may not actually be a paleo lake basin. But then in slide 42, I'm showing an example of the more typical features consistent with empty lakes that show their elevations consistent with Lagia Mare. And in slide 43, it's just showing, again, that the bottom of the lakes are consistent with the shoreline of Lagia Mare, and the top show a wide, varied terrain near the surface. And then summarizing this part of the talk in slide 44, we've seen that the drought topography in the North Polar region has revealed both a dynamic and a passive evolutionary history. We've seen multi-layered plateaus. That's that second landscape I showed that suggests a landscape of flat, something that planates the surface, followed by dissection. These conical depressions we're seeing, you can't make them through fluvial erosion, so we need some other process. The leading candidate is karstic dissolution, but then you have to come up with where the material that's soluble comes from. And that those bright lakes that we now think are empty paleo lake basins all have a common elevation in the area, regional area of the large seas. It would be very interesting to see what their elevation is outside of those large seas. And I'm realizing that I was so excited about this portion, these top two portions of the talk, that we've only got 7 minutes left in the telecon, and it will take me about 15 to go through the wave talk. So I think we might open the floor for questions for people who have to leave at 3. And then depending on how long the telecon line is open, I can go forward with the wave talk after we've exhausted questions on Titan history and the lakes. But I'll let Sean, who's our moderator, make that decision. Sean?
Well, I'm kind of more tempted to just hold off any questions that I might have and let you go on for the next 15 minutes. Our hour or so is kind of fluid, but perhaps it's not a bad idea to stop for a moment right now and take any brief questions if any are out there. Okay, and so if not, Alex, why don't you go on ahead and talk about the waves, and we can open it for questions right after that.
Sounds great. Thanks, Sean. Again, sorry for that first part taking so long, but I do think it's a very interesting, and those are all new results that the radar team has been putting together, so I thought it was interesting to go through them. Another interesting paper that has just come out, you can read it in the Icarus website, I think it's on Papers and Press right now, is talking about the observation that I mentioned earlier, showing that there are glints that Vins has seen at Titan Lakes, and we haven't seen any evidence for waves so far, which has been a mystery, because we see these beautiful equatorial dunes that require winds capable of saltating sand-sized particles to create these 100-meter-high, 300-meter-wide piles of sand formed into longitudinal dunes, but yet we don't see evidence for waves in the lakes. And the reason that's so interesting for radar specifically is shown by slide 45, which is a typical radar image of Nantucket, off of Nantucket Island in Massachusetts on the eastern seaboard. And it's an L-band image at 25 centimeters, but the primary point is that on slide 45, there are literally, there's the only land of Nantucket Island that you see near the upper middle, the upper right portion of the slide. Everything else is wave structure on the surface of the ocean because of water so reflective to the radar and that the waves are highly responsive to the centimeter class wavelength. In fact, all those features are associated with atmospheric waves that are causing ocean waves, bottom reflections of larger scale waves coming up, and perhaps more interestingly is the storm front you see coming in the latter part of the slide. You see a border of really bright textured material moving up, and that is a wind front for a storm that's coming in. And we have to contrast slide 45 with slide 46, which is an image of Ontario Lochis in the south polar region of Titan, showing a very dark liquid lake that's showing no evidence for waves. And on slide 47, I show a thin track, which is an altimetry swath, which was a Christmas present that we received in December 2009. Now, Ontario Lochis is one of my favorite features on Titan, and we could talk about its shoreline morphology for hours, but what I really want to focus on here is that when you look at this altimetry track across the lake, you're getting nadir return. And it's a little bit of detailed radar physics in slide 48, but I really want to talk through it because it's very fascinating, the results you can get from it. The histogram that pops up when you go to slide 48 is from a paper by Lauren Wye, who did her thesis work on this topic at Stanford. And what it's showing is that the way the radar works is you send out a sinusoidally varying echo or power amount of light that from the radar that gets reflected off the surface and received. And if you histogram the amount of power you get back from whatever you sent out over a rough surface, because the surface facets are completely phased into and out of the size of the wavelength of the radar, some are exactly 1 millionth apart and everything in between, you end up with a Gaussian distribution, which is the black distribution you see on the histogram. But instead, when we looked over the lake, you saw the red histogram, which has the histogram of a sinusoidal shape, a saddle function that looks nothing like a Gaussian, and also you can see it's quantized. We only have data at specific histogram bins, which correspond to specific amplitudes of power. And what that's really showing us is that we're receiving an exact duplicate of the sinusoidal echo we sent out, and the reason that it's quantized in what bins you see is because you're readily receiving the energy over a constant time period, and that the difference between those bins is actually the integration time of the radar's receiver, and the reason it looks like a saddle shape is because that's the histogram of the signal we sent out. And the only way to get this observation is to have an almost purely specular return off that surface, and Lauren was able to analyze that to determine that the roughness of the surface over the 200-meter length scale of the Fresnel zone, the area that would return back to the radar in the specular direction, was less than 3 millimeters. So Ontario Lochis surface was less than 3 millimeters RMS at the time of this observation. So if you ever wanted to go water skiing on Titan, this is where you'd go. If this entire lake is filled with liquid, there's actually some debate over whether this is a liquid lake or a mudflat or only partially liquid. But the point is, it's extremely flat, which is strong evidence for it being a liquid surface. And coming up in a month, we're going to be repeating this observation, but over a North Polar Lake, during a time period, as we'll see in a second, when things might not be so quiet. And just this histogram led me to wonder three things, which is shown on slide 49, which is how do you generate waves? How do you expect to observe waves? And can you detect waves? And this led me down the path of talking to some terrestrial oceanographers and doing one of the things I really love about planetary science, which is the ability to jump into different subfields and learn something and apply it to a drastically different environment. And so I met up with Mark Donnellan, who is one of the world's foremost experts on terrestrial wave generation, and said, let's take your theories and transfer them to Titan and try to understand how you transfer energy from the wind to the waves and figure out how you make waves in a hydrocarbon lake and whether we'd expect to observe them, and then lastly, whether we expect to detect them. during this process, I learned very quickly that there was this great quote in 1956 by a review paper in Classical Mechanics by a professor named Ursel saying, wind blowing over a water surface generates waves in the water by a physical process that cannot be regarded as known. And despite having 50-plus years of time to research this, we still don't know the exact way you generate waves on a water surface, but we have at least some theories. The point being, it's a difficult physical topic in oceanography. In slide 50, I'm really showing a physical depiction or a cartoon depiction of how we generate waves. I don't want to go into the detailed physics, but I'll say you start with an initially undisturbed surface shown in the upper left. And if you have turbulence in your air, so vertical pressure gradients that's in turbulence, and you advect that air over a liquid surface, if that air is moving at the same speed as the liquid is moving, the phase speed of a wave that would move with a length scale equal to the vertical pressure gradient and the turbulence, a very interesting scenario, you would linearly grow that wave like a random walk to micron scale sizes. And the real take home is once you start any kind of disturbance on the liquid surface, that disturbance modifies the airflow above it in an instability mechanism initially written about by a famous oceanographer named Miles, John Miles. And what Miles says is that you have a feedback mechanism where the surface disturbance modifies the logarithmic airflow above you, which generates a new surface disturbance, and you have a feedback mechanism where you have an exponentially growing surface wave at a specific wavelength associated with that feedback. And the growth weight of that growth mechanism was most recently theoretically derived by Mark Donnellan and experimentally verified, who was my collaborator on this work. And I show the equation for the growth rate on the bottom part of the slide there, where the growth is related to the density of your air and your liquid, which is rho A and rho F, the wind speed, which is u at a specific height, since wind speed varies with height, divided by the phase speed of the wave. The cosine term just talks about the difference between the way the wave is moving and the wind's moving, and then there's a square in there. And really, you're balancing for initial wave generation this growth mechanism that was initially theoretically suggested by Miles with viscous dissipation. And the wave speeds are determined by the dispersion relation, which balances surface tension for small-scale waves with gravity for large-scale waves. And all of these different physical parameters that I'm discussing would suggest that Titan would be easier to generate waves because the air density is four times greater, so that growth rate goes up by a factor of four. The fluid density is one-half that of water, so it goes up by another factor of two. And the phase speeds of the waves are less because surface tension is four times less and gravity is one-seventh. So everything suggests that wind speed should move slower. It should be easier to generate waves. And in slide 51, I'm showing some of Mark Donnellan's experimental results in a wave tank where he took his theories, which allowed for variations in liquid viscosity, density, surface tension, all the things that you would expect to vary the growth of waves, and showed that in his wave tank, these plots show no waves, or you're at the noise floor of these sensors, which are actually Ku band radars. That's the flat part of each graph. And then at some wind speed, you see a jump, where all of a sudden you see a lot higher reflectance from the radar, suggesting the presence of surface waves, and that Mark's theories correctly predicted the position of that jump to when you started seeing waves as a function of changing water temperature and density. And we took those theories and re-derived them for Titan, and the results are shown on slide 52, which says, focusing on the right-hand part of the plot, we have wavelengths of the wave you want to excite versus the wind speed on the y-axis that you need to excite it. And the wind speeds you need to excite waves on Titan are primarily determined by the viscosity of the liquid, which, as I mentioned two slides ago, is what determines the dissipation mechanism and the balance between energy input from the wind and dissipation through viscous dissipation. So it turns out when you work through the numbers that you need between 0.4 to 0.7 meter per second winds to generate waves on a Titan hydrocarbon lake that's varied in composition between pure methane rain, which would be the lowest viscosity that corresponds to 0.4 meters per second, and more of the complex mixtures of equilibrium with the atmosphere. So if you're in thermodynamic equilibrium, you can also predict a composition of your liquid, and Daniel Cordier has been prevalent in publishing those estimates, and the viscosity for those fluid mixtures would say about 0.7 meters per second to generate waves. And ethane, which I show as a dash, kind of a smaller dashed line on the plot, needs about 0.6 meters per second. So if Titan's lakes are primarily made of ethane, you need about 0.6 meter per second winds at a height of 10 meters in order to generate the waves. On Earth, which I show with the white plots, you need between 1.6 to 2 meters per second. So it is, in fact, easier to generate waves on Titan by a factor of 4 or 5 or so. Again, I'll repeat, we need about 0.6 meter per second waves, according to this theory, to generate initial disturbances that would be observable to the radar that would not have caused that observation of spectral reflection on Terra Locus or the surface glints observed by VIM of 0.6 meters per second. So now we move to slide 53, which really shows the seminal plot for all this work. It's a result of a GCM made by Tapio Schneider at Caltech. He's now in Sweden. And what Tapio's model shows is those two lines show as a function of year, which is the x-axis, time of year, which I plotted as planet concentric solar longitude, or season, on the x-axis, and the y-axis shows the wind speed at 10 meters. The two lines correspond to the latitudes of Kraken Mare in the north in white and Ontario Locus in the south in gray. And the hashed bars between 0.4 and 0.8 meters per second there are the range of winds that correspond to generating waves for viscosities ranging from liquid methane to complex equilibrium conditions, with 0.6 in the middle being liquid ethane. I've also put the positions of the prime, equinox, and solstice portions of the Cassini mission on the x-axis, along with, when I generated this plot, we were still in the NASA Discovery competition for the Time mission, and I excitedly put what things would be like during Time's arrival at Legiamare on this plot as well. The main point, though, is that center section around L sub S of 0 that I label as equinox mission is where all the observations of no waves have been made, and both those lines are well below the crosshatch threshold of what we would need in terms of wind speed to generate waves. And what's interesting is that if you look at today, moving on through around 2015 or greater, we're moving into a period in the North Polar region where the winds are expected, based on the models, to freshen. In fact, this model by Tetsuyu Takano is the most conservative. Other models actually predict slightly higher wind speeds, but I wanted to use the most conservative model that says that during the Cassini solstice mission, which is also pointed out on the x-axis, we might get winds large enough to generate waves on these hydrocarbon lakes and seas. And so the prediction is that if the lakes and seas are made of the compositions we expect and they don't have some kind of surfactant surface layer of crud or something, we might start to see waves in the coming years. And the last question you want to ask is, well, can you observe them? Water is highly reflective in the microwave. I know on slide 54 now, and that is why when you look at a radar image of a liquid surface, it's almost always extremely bright. The primary component of that brightness is coming from what's known as the Bragg resident component. And if you take a random sea surface, as I've shown in the left-hand part of this slide, this is from a thesis work by Collier, you can break it into its components, and there will be one component with a wavelength that has the right crest spacing between the waves such that the path length back to the radar is exactly equal to one multiple of the wavelength, which means that you coherently add that energy, and you significantly increase the radar return of that component, and it turns out that this phenomenon of Bragg backscatter dominates the radar signal of incidence angles greater than 15 degrees of wavy sea surfaces, and is also the dominant component of almost any radar image that you see of Earth's ocean, and is utilized to do things like measure wind speeds from the amplitude of the waves on the ocean using radar sensors in orbit. So using this Bragg theory, on slide 55, I've done a two-layer model predicting, based on theoretical predictions and empirical predictions of what the distribution of the wavelengths would be for a hydrocarbon sea on Titan or a water surface on Earth. You can take that distribution, put it into the Bragg theory, along with a couple of the components of the model, including a gustiness parameter and tilting large-scale wave surfaces such that you change the incidence angle, to predict the actual response from the Cassini radar of a Titan hydrocarbon sea for a given wind speed. On the left-hand plot of this side of the plot, we're seeing results for water on Earth, And on the right, I'm showing, again, we're on slide 55, I'm showing the results for liquid hydrocarbon on Titan. And the x-axis shows wing speed in units of meters per second at a height of 10 meters. And the y-axis shows the response of the radar in the decibels of synthetic aperture of a normalized radar cross-section. And then the different solid dashed lines correspond to those different viscosities we talked about that correspond to different liquid compositions. But the main take-home point is that for wind speeds below 1 meter per second, which is the wind speeds we expect based on the models of Titan's atmosphere, our climate system, you're expecting to see responses below minus 25 dB, which I put a white line on because that's the noise floor of the Cassini radar when in star mode. So we could have wavy surfaces on Titan, but we may not see them in the images because they just aren't bright enough. And the reason that they're not bright enough is because liquid hydrocarbon is, as I mentioned in the very beginning of the talk, much more transparent and less reflective than water through microwave observations. However, if we use the real aperture portion of the Cassini radar instead of the imaging mode, which we also get during every pass, that has a noise floor of minus 50 dB, which is off the y-axis of this chart altogether, and so we still might be able to detect the waves from off-axis scatterometry observations, but regardless of this discussion, we can certainly see the waves when we do dedicated altimetry observations or VIM sets up for these glimpse observations. And in slide 56, I just sum up this part of the talk saying that threshold wind speeds to generate waves on Titan it's 2.5 to 4 times easier to generate waves in terms of wind speed on Titan than Earth, but that the current TCM suggests that because Titan is a slow rotator with such low thermal gradients, we still haven't seen winds that are strong enough to generate these waves yet, although the GCMs all predict that during the solstice of June, we may start seeing them, and that the presence or absence of these waves may actually be used as a constraint on whether the GCMs are doing their job and help us choose between which GCM is more realistic on Titan, and also put constraints on the viscosity of the fluid, which links to its composition and tells us something about what it's made of. Slide 57, I guess, make a last point about surfactants. On Earth, when you have an oil slick, it's oil on troubled waters in the Bible, it lowers your waves. And the reason it does it is because you create a surface layer of an extra layer of dissipation. So if you had a surfactant on Titan that are covered at the top layer of the hydrocarbon liquid, that actually could also dissipate waves. And then in slide 58, I just show an image from JHUACL and NASA that was put out for the Cassini Time mission. And I just need to say that we came ever so close to sending the first extraterrestrial boat to a Titan lake. And I just really hope that some of the questions I brought up in this talk can be answered in the future by a lake lander, either sponsored by NASA or ESA, that may go visit Titan and actually land in one of those hydrocarbon seas, tell us what they're actually made of, whether there are waves or not, and how those seas evolve. And I think, given the time, we will not go through my guide to desert vacationing, so I hope you guys are not hydrophobic, and I will take any questions, and thank you for your time.
Alex, well, thank you very much for a really interesting and rather ambitious talk. And as you said, the floor is open for any questions. Okay, well, hearing none, then I will start off with my own question. And this kind of goes back to the basins that you talked about, the depressions near La Jemmare. And I'm a little confused because you said that, you know, for the most part, they have the absolute depth is comparable to that of La Jemmare. So why aren't they flooded? What am I missing?
Well, okay, the concept, and again, this is new results, but the concept is that first of all, the error on our knowledge of how deep these things are is plus or minus 50 meters. So the way to think about it is that things that are deep, that have absolute elevations that are equal to the La Jemmare depth or deeper, are where we see what we presumably be the lakes that are filled with hydrocarbon in the region, and that ones that are shallower than that depth are able to be dry. And so They may be only a couple of meters above the level of a Jemmare, but they're near that absolute level. And the main importance of that is saying that whatever is generating the hole, the mechanism that's making that hole in the ground, is stopping at that level, presumably because there's some kind of either impermeable layer or more likely an alkanifer table. And so the real result is that you don't see Below that level, you don't see any of these empty depressions. So anything that's deeper than the shoreline of Lake Jamari is filled with liquid, and anything that's shallower than it is not filled with liquid in the region of Lake Jamari. But interesting, even more interesting, is that you don't see many depressions that have these bright evaporite deposits that are shallower than the depth of Lake Jamari, which suggests that the time scale of generating that hole is fast compared to the time scale associated with changing the liquid level of GMRA on 50,000-year time scales. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. I think the devil, someone in the details, you have to think about the, like you said, sort of the what the error is and our knowledge of the depths.
What I'm saying is if those empty lakes were any deeper, they would be liquid-filled, but they're not. And the deepest you can get of depression that's not filled with liquid in this region under this model would be that depth. And the fact that we only see these empty lake deposits at that depth is saying that not only is it consistent with saying that things deeper than the shoreline of the lake are liquid-filled, but whatever's creating the hole is operating on timescales faster than the timescale associated with changing that liquid level.
So another question, I was really struck when you talked about essentially how wet Titan is. You're talking about you were comparing the volatile content. For example, you're saying that if you were to condense out all the water vapor in the atmosphere on the Earth, it'd be about a centimeter, but you know the same volatiles on Titan would be, what did you say, 7 to 8 meters thick?
Yeah, all the methane on Titan's atmosphere would make a global equivalent layer of 7 meters of Earth, which is about an inch or 2.5 centimeters.
Right, so this thing is really, really, really wet. And a lot of analogies are drawn between what Titan looks like and what the Earth looks like. And isn't that almost kind of surprising, given how much wetter Titan is than the Earth? Or are there certain distinctions you can see that are born of this,
Well, the amount of volatile... Yeah, the amount of volatile in the atmosphere doesn't generally... trivially equate to a lot more rain evaporation. That doesn't mean there's a lot more activity of liquid being deposited onto the surface and interacting with the atmosphere, because there's other things that go into that, which involve the temperature, which is a lot colder on Titan, temperature gradients, which are much lower on Titan, and the wind speeds. And so you really have to go into a full global climate model to predict how often does it rain, how much does it rain, what are the rates of evaporation, and those actually show a situation that's quite similar to places on Earth. So the amount of total volatile in the system is not the only component of the climate system and the hydrologic system, and you really have to look it all together to get at the rates and make comparisons. Energetically, Titan is very similar to Earth in terms of the amount of erosion you expect and the amount of liquid that you expect precipitated out of the atmosphere.
So it's more complicated than just one really interesting number.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than that, because you really have to take into account the energy in the system, since every time you change phase or you do any kind of these erosive mechanisms, you take up energy.
Are there any other questions up there? Okay, then I'm going to continue on with another one or two that I had. You mentioned there being another Ontario Locus flyby. Is that T91, do you have to recall?
Yeah, it's actually not Ontario Locus. We're looking at Lake Jamari, and it's T91, T92, and T91 is coming up around Memorial Day, and they are targeted observations. One of the things that's really exciting on the upcoming Solstice mission is that a lot of these observations of Titan are targeting specific science questions as opposed to just exploratory, and T91 and T92 are prime examples where we're actually looking for waves on Lake Jamari, and we're looking for the evolution of a collection of small lakes in the north. So you can look for some results and press releases that may come out in the late May, early June timeframe if anything really exciting is found in those flybys.
Yeah, that should be interesting, just in time for the June PSG, I hope something interesting is found. And I think my final question, given what you've been talking about with potential for waves and things like that, with a mission such as Time, if you could choose, sending it to a lake that was wavy or a lake that was flat, which would you pick? Which would be scientifically more beneficial, the wavy lake or the flat lake?
Well, they're both interesting scientifically because they're telling you there's a reason why it's wavy and there's a reason why it isn't wavy. But from an engineering standpoint, I would probably say a lake that doesn't have significant waves on it would be a little bit safer for a lake lander, especially if it ever got beached and was subject to waves hitting it. But I think that I just want to get a lander to a Titan lake, and we won't expect to see significant waves anyway. If, at most, we're expecting waves to be something like, you know, 0.2 meters or like 0.5 foot high. So I think that the ideal scenario would be land in a lake and stay there long enough to see when it's flat and calm and to see when it starts getting a little bit windy and therefore we have small-scale waves to pick up, because the actual distribution of the waves, if you can image them with a camera or even get perhaps their topography with some kind of altimetry device or laser scanner, you can actually say a lot about the meteor, the wind environment, and the liquid itself. So in the sense that you can use waves as a tool to understand some of the processes happening in the liquid and some of its compositional effects, I would love to see small-scale waves if we ever did land in a Titan lake.
Yeah, I agree. That would be a really interesting mission. Okay, so if there are no other questions out there, please stop me if anyone does have any questions.
Nope, thank you.
I would like to thank our speaker again, Dr. Alex Hayes. Thank you very much for a really interesting talk. Perhaps at some point in the future we can have you come back and give the desert portion of this talk.
Sure, and there's a lot of interesting things to say about Titan students as well. We'd be happy to.
All right, great. Thank you very much, and so I'll be signing off, and goodbye to everyone. We will be having the next Charm Telecon in July, so expect to hear from me in about that time frame. Take care, and we will talk to you later. Bye-bye.